You're listening to the Locked On Nuggets podcast, your daily podcast on the Denver Nuggets. Now, here is your host from DenverStiffs.com, Adam Mottis.
What is up, everybody? Happy Monday. Welcome to the Locked On Nuggets podcast, part of the Locked On NBA Network. I'm your host, Adam Mottis from DenverStiffs.com, the largest Denver Nuggets blog and community on the web. Check us out. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Today's episode of the show, I'm going to pick up where I left off with these previews on three players. I take one starter, one reserve, and one end-of-bench guy, and I just try to look at what I expect from the season, what the best-case scenario is, and what the worst-case scenario is. And up today, first we're going to start with Plumlee in segment one. In segment two, we're going to look at Juancho Hernangómez, who, it's weird, he's in the end-of-bench guy, but there is a chance he's actually just a rotation piece. There's even a chance he's a starter, quite frankly. And then we're going to finish with Paul Millsap, who has sneakily been, I think, Denver's second most important and best player for the last two seasons when healthy. So a lot of interesting stuff. Before we get started, though, Jokic played some basketball over the weekend. How great was this? I didn't realize how much I needed some Jokic basketball in my life until this weekend. He had a friendly, an exhibition game, playing with Team Serbia. He had not been practicing with the team. I think he had one or two days of practice total prior to that game, and it showed. Not a lot of chemistry, but it was just great to see him out on the court playing against the Lithuanian national team. Michael Malone and Arturis Karnisovas, Arturis, the general manager for the Denver Nuggets. Tim Conley, president of basketball operations, he's the one that gets talked about a lot, gets a lot of the credit. But Arturis, I think, sort of the unsung hero of this Denver Nuggets front office, who has been behind the scenes instrumental in a lot of what the team has done. I think really the way to look at it, from my understanding of it, and really from what I've seen and heard and talked to people, I think Tim Conley and Arturis are sort of, they're a combo, they're a duo, and Tim is the face of the operation. He's the one that's out front in front of the cameras the most, but Arturis a huge part of it. So both of them sitting courtside to watch this exhibition. It was really, really cool. Shows you the commitment they had, because this was in Belgrade. So they were flying all the way across the country to, or all the way across the globe to watch. Really, really cool to see. And then Jok, you know, he looked good, I thought. You always wonder this time of year, this is like pre-training camp, what kind of shape is he going to be in? I thought Jok looked great. His lungs looked fine. The skill, you could tell a little rusty early on, but took over the game down the stretch. And I don't have his stat line in front of me. I don't know what it was, but down the stretch in the fourth quarter, Serbia trailing basically the entire game, and they rallied back to win it at the very end in front of a crowd that really, I think, appreciated the close game and the big rally. And Jokic was at the center of it. I mean, he's so clearly the best player on the court, and will likely be the best player on the court in every single game they play. Maybe if they play Giannis, that won't be the case. But he looked really, really good, and it was fun to see. There should be more exhibition games coming up. This is what's cool. The series that we're doing, where we're talking about players and what to expect from them, it's going to lead us right into the FIBA World Cup, where we're going to have games, actual games to talk about, both with Juancho Hernangómez and with Nikola Jokic. So it was cool to kind of take a break from the offseason to watch real live basketball in one form, and that was great. So Jok looked good. All right, let's get into this, because we don't have too much time. But Mason Plumlee, we go back to last year. He's a really interesting season ahead for Mason Plumlee. I think when you look at the way the roster is constructed, he's a bit of an X factor, and I guess I'll get into that here in just a second. 21 minutes per game last year, 7.8 points per game, 6.4 rebounds, 3 assists, the highest box plus minus of his career. He had a 3.8 box plus minus, which was his best. And whether or not you're into advanced stats, but you don't need to know how box plus minus, how it's made, what how it spits out the number that it does, but you need to know that it's my favorite sort of catch-all metric for when you're just trying to say how much value does a player have. Now, it's not a great metric. None of these catch-alls are great. A lot of them, they're just kind of raw painting in broad broad strokes, trying to say, okay, this is how good of a season this guy had, or this is how valuable he is. So the fact that he had the best career box plus minus last year, in 3.9 of that was defensive. He was actually a minus 0.1 offensive box plus minus. It just goes to show that I think Plumlee, such a smart player, and he this being, now that he's been in Denver for a couple of seasons, I think he sort of learned where he is most impactful and what the team needs for him from him. He shot 74.4% at the rim. That's the second highest of his career behind his rookie season. His rookie year in Brooklyn, he was primarily a DeAndre Jordan type. I think he came into the league and that's what was expected of him. You're going to pick and roll, super athletic, just finish above the rim and just dunk everything. So he's finished a little bit higher at the rim that season, but he was also finishing much more specific type shots that year. So the fact that he shot the best of his career at the rim this last year at 28, 29 years old, I think that's really encouraging that, one, he still has a lot in the tank. Obviously, he's not like over the hill or anything. But two, that I think he knows where his shots are coming from, and that's kind of a big sign of a player that knows now how to read the court alongside the other players he's playing with. He had the highest dunk rate for whatever that's worth, so not surprising given how well he shot. And then he was just great next to Jokic, the second best two-man net rating on the team. And two-man net rating, not always the best way to evaluate, meaning when he was on the court alongside Jokic, the Nuggets were as good as any other combo minus one. I think the Jokic-Millsap combo was the number one. So one question I have that I think is a fair question, are we certain that Jeremy Grant is an upgrade over Mason Plumlee? I think clearly given the age, Jeremy Grant is the, you know, I think Denver wants Jeremy Grant to be the long-term Plumlee and Millsap replacement, not just replacing one guy, but sort of replacing both. He's got a little bit of a combination of both games. But are we certain that, oh, you add Jeremy Grant, Denver's going to go up a level? You're already talking about Jokic Millsap was phenomenal. Jokic Plumlee was phenomenal. So you're almost, in theory, improving on something that was already really, really good. So I think there's a legitimate reason to wonder if Jeremy Grant can be as productive as Mason Plumlee was in that similar role, especially alongside Jokic. Jokic Lyles, by the way, had the worst offensive rebound percentage of all two-man Jokic lineups. And the reason I bring that up, we know that the Jokic-Lyles combination was not very successful, and there's a handful of reasons for it. But I think this might be number one, and I've really hammered home how important offensive rebounding is alongside Jokic, especially if you can play that dunker spot. And I've referenced Fareed several times. In addition to being the best front court pairing offensively that the Nuggets have had over the entire Jokic era, it was also far and away the best offensive rebounding duo that the Nuggets have had. So I think that there's a real strong correlation to how well you can offensive rebound from the power forward position and how good of a fit you are alongside Jokic. And Jokic Plumlee lineups rebounded phenomenally well, offensive rebounded very well, had the second highest true shooting percentage of all Jokic lineups. True shooting just sort of factors in how frequently you're taking and making three-pointers as well as getting to the free throw line. So rather than just raw field goal percentage, using true shooting percentage is a better grade for how efficient your offense has been. Second best, Jokic Plumlee, the second best of all Jokic lineups. And Plumlee just does. I think one of the big things that people miscalculate when they talk about, oh, who would be a good fit alongside Jokic, they always think, ooh, spacing, he can shoot the three, and oh, if only Plumlee could shoot the three. And I just don't buy that, because I think the more important thing is how well do you offensive rebound, and then of course the defensive end, there's a whole bunch of other stuff there, but how well you offensive rebound from an offensive standpoint, more important in my opinion than that extra spacing from shooting the three. And then it's important with Plumlee, when we talk about him, it's important that he had this phenomenal season, best he's had in Denver, and he was an absolute disaster in the playoffs, the worst net rating of anybody on the team. And it's hard to make sense of why, because Plumlee is a veteran player, been in the playoffs before, and he was really, really ineffective. And I don't really exactly understand why that was, but it's worth noting that he was that bad. So maybe there's something to it. Best case scenario for him this season, I think 23 minutes per game, which is, he's played now 23 minutes one season, 20 another, and 21, I think, last season. So playing 23 minutes per game, that would be an increase. And it's tough because there's only 17 minutes per game available for the backup center position. So the only way that he could get up to 23 minutes per game is if he was playing, you know, some minutes at the power forward. And that would mean he's replacing either Jeremy Grant or Paul Millsap. But at least just for the sake of argument, best case scenario, maybe there's some minute. Maybe Grant plays a little at the three. And that opened Millsap reducing his role, and that opens up some minutes for him. I put 9.5 points per game, 8 rebounds per game, including 2.5 offensive rebounds per game. That would be, both would be career highs. So 23, he gets in there, but he's really hammering the board, offensive boards hard. And if you look at him, I think he's had a steady increase in his offensive rebound rate. Perhaps, again, just because of the chemistry between him and Jokic and maybe him and some of the other players on the team that have allowed him to become a better offensive rebounder. But to me, that's going to be maybe arguably his most important offensive skill. And then he just, in a vacuum, has his best season yet. He's 29 years old. This would be his age 29 season. It's entirely possible. This is peak Mason Plumlee. So best case scenario includes him having his best season. And then just doesn't see a drop-off in the playoffs. We have to put that caveat on there. Come playoff time, you know, he'll be playing reduced minutes. But if he can just be a boost, then clearly Denver, I think, will be better off in a playoff series. Worst case scenario, 12 minutes per game, only plays the backup center position, does not play any power forward. The Plumlee-Jokic lineup is over, and we just never see it, or we only see it, you know, whenever players are hurt or whatever. So 12 minutes per game, and he's less effective than both Jeremy Grant and Paul Millsap alongside Jokic. Now, this is like a best worst-case scenario for Denver. It's worse for Plumlee, but it's best for Denver, because if Grant and Millsap outplay him and just clearly outplay him, that means they're playing really, really well. So that would be the case. And then another question you have to kind of ask yourself is, if Plumlee's role gets reduced the way, on paper at least, it seems like it is ready to be, how is that going to affect the other aspects of his game, including his free throw percentage? You know, it's hard to play 12 minutes per game. It's a lot easier to play 28 minutes per game, because it's not enough for you to be like completely drained and exhausted while you're on the court, but it's enough for you to be, have a rhythm and know when you're playing. If you're playing 12 minutes per game, that's basically two stints. You know, Jokic takes two rests, one at the end of the first quarter, one at the end of the third quarter, and that's it. You only get in, and you think about that. If that's what you're playing, you might warm up for a game, sit for you know, 20 minutes between intros and game time and everything else. You might sit for 20 minutes, go out and play in real time for like 10 minutes, go back to the bench for, I don't know, 40 minutes, and then go back out. It's just really, really choppy and tough to do. So there's a chance that he shoots below 50% from the free throw line like he did two seasons ago, and everything, his finishing at the rim, everything, his defense all takes a slide. I think it's a real risk for Plumlee if his minutes get reduced. My prediction is actually somewhat close to the worst case scenario. I think he plays 16 minutes per game. And I came to this conclusion by just looking at who's going to play power forward minutes and center minutes. And like I mentioned, there's those, I don't know, 15, 16 minutes per game at backup center. But then the power forward position, there's, you know, even Wancho, Chanchar, Michael Porter Jr. There's a lot of other options for that spot. So I think he's strictly a backup center. And I think that he is traded at the deadline. That's kind of my hot take prediction for the year for Plumlee. I think he's a player that it makes sense to move, and probably at the deadline after he's provided a little bit of value. Any fantasy football fans out there, don't forget to check out Locked On Fantasy Football. Vinny Iyer, Locked On Fantasy Football, gives you the edge with over 20 years covering fantasy football. So check that out. We got a lot of great shows on the network, so you're going to want to, you know, search the entire network, put Locked On into your phone and see what you like there. But fantasy football season, get prepared. I know a lot of people will be drafting this weekend, so give that a listen. Check it out. Let me know what you think. Hit me up on Twitter and let me know if you've learned some things. All right, let's get on to Juancho Hernangómez, another player that's just super fascinating. This was a tough one to do, because everybody knows I remain Juancho Hernangómez's biggest believer. I'm a big Juancho stan. I think that he makes the Nuggets better. And I've said this, I haven't referenced this in a while, but, you know, I was, as a player, my mentality, I was a passing big. And so there's certain players that I always, they have certain traits that I always identify with as, that's perfect. Those are the type of players that make my job easier as a passer. Well, obviously, Denver's built around Nikola Jokic, the best passing big man of all time. Full stop, in my opinion, no questions asked. And Juancho is a guy that I think is just elite. Elite as a Jokic pairing. On January 1st of this year, so of course, big story, Juancho gets hurt sometime around early January, first or second week of January. He gets hurt and completely falls off a cliff. But prior to that, the first 2.5 months of the season, you look at October, November, December, all of those, that entire stretch, Juancho had the second best pairing alongside Jokic behind Mason Plumlee. Offensively, he was elite next to Jokic. He was shooting the ball, the leather off the ball. He was fantastic. And here's what's crazy. He played 19 minutes per game last year. Total. This was including after the drop-off. This isn't just the first half of the season. Total, he played 19 minutes per game last year, and that included 25 starts. He started 25 games. So, you know, that's a lot of minutes and a lot of starts for a guy that we're talking about as a player that might not even be in the rotation. And maybe for better or for worse. So if he's not in the rotation, is the person that he is replacing going to be better than him at his best, or just better than him at his average when you factor in the good Juancho and the bad Juancho that took over the second half of the season after he got hurt? So that's a real question. But he has elite chemistry with Jokic. The two are very good, you know, get along in the locker room. Juancho's like the most supportive teammate ever, especially for Jokic, just loves the guy. And so, to me, he's a guy that the best version of the Nuggets features him in some capacity. And it's crazy because I, at the moment, have him on the outside of the rotation looking in. There's three huge questions for Juancho, I think, coming into this season. Number one, can he stay healthy for a full season? This is the biggest question, you know, easily looking at him, because his first season, he was a rookie. So, you know, he wasn't put in position to have to play that many games. He ends up playing 62. He started 9 as a rookie, but he only played 13.5 minutes per game, so he didn't wear himself out. The following season, he gets mono. Basically, throw out that entire season. Just, he was terrible. He played 25 games only. He started 3 of them, and he was terrible. He shot 28% from 3, which we know Juancho is a better shooter than that. So can he play? And then this last year, he gets injured halfway through the year, and you look at his frame and his body. He has not added muscle the way that I think maybe you would hoped, given his frame and given his body. He's still very much a very skinny player, and can he handle 82 games, especially at a high rate? It's a real question for him. Is he an 82-game player and not a 16-game player? Here's the thing that's difficult about him and how he's gotten hurt each year is we haven't seen what he looked like in a playoff setting. I love the way he moves off ball. I love the way he shoots. I don't love the way he defends. Below average defender and vulnerable to really good wings. Like, I don't think he's going to guard your LeBrons or Kawhis or Paul Georges or whatever, and not even a little bit, not even in a way that makes, you know, he's not even going to be a nuisance to them. I think they're going to look forward and lick their chops when they see him on the other end. So the question is he more of a guy that's going to look great against the Charlotte Hornets on Tuesday in February, and then in a playoff setting, it's like, man, we just cannot play this guy? That's a real question I have. And one of the questions I think Michael Malone and his staff are going to have to decide it early on is, who are the guys that we believe in and we're willing to give an opportunity to develop over the course of the season, so that come April, May, and June, we know who our main guys are? And I'm not sure if Juancho is that guy. I'm very convinced that he is that guy in October, November, December, but his weaknesses, it's not that I think he won't be that guy. It's just that we don't know, and we haven't seen enough of him to really, really know. And then the last big question is, will he even get a chance? He's had 3 years. Two of them, he's been largely healthy. So, you know, the window of opportunity in the NBA can be really, really short. And then when you look at that combo, small forward, power forward position, it's the one that has the most, you know, it's the most up for grabs. Is Will Barton going to be the starter? Is he going to be the backup at small forward? How much is Malik Beasley going to slide over? Michael Porter Jr., Vlatko Chanchar, Jeremy Grant even maybe, you know, eats into some of the minutes he would play. And then Vlatko Chanchar, who can't shoot the ball nearly as well as Juancho, but I think is equally as smart of an off-ball player. I love the way he cuts and moves and reads the court off-ball. But he's not as good of a shooter, but he's much stronger and a much better defender. So does he sort of replace Juancho in that same role? That's a real question. Best case scenario, though, I think is 20 minutes per game. I don't think he's going to play more than that. 20 minutes per game would be really, really good for him. He played 19.5 last year, which I was surprised to see. But given all the talent on the roster, I'd be surprised if he played more than 20. And then 42% from three. He's capable of it. He hasn't done it yet in his career, but in the healthy portions of his career, he's almost averaged that. I mean, or better. So he's I always say that three-point shooting is equal parts ability and shot selection, and Juancho has both. He's not like Jimmer Fredette or Kyle Korver-level shooter, but he is, I think, smart enough to know where his shots come from and doesn't take bad ones, so his percentage is going to be up. I think there's a chance he has the best offensive rating, or the Nuggets have the best offensive rating when he is on the court. That's just what he provides, is that extra cutting, spacing, and offensive rebounding. So I mentioned how important that is. He's such a unique player in that he's a great three-point shooter, but he has great instincts for and a great nose for the offensive glass. 1.5 offensive rebounds per game. I think he averaged one last year, which is really good for 19 minutes per game. Maybe he bumps that up even more. And then another best-case scenario, plays 70 games fully healthy. So it's not, last year he played like 70 games, but he was healthy for about 35 of them. This year, if he plays 70 games and he's healthy the entire time, that would be a real boost to him as a player. I think he would earn a lot of money if he's able to do that. Worst case scenario, just completely out of the rotation. And this is the hard part for him. I mean, it's a very real possibility that he's just an end of bench player that is buried, not just the third stringer at small forward, but he's sort of the third or fourth stringer at every position he might play and just never gets that chance. 35% from three. If his shot leaves him, then he's just not a useful tool. His shot is such a big part of what makes him a weapon. So if he shot 35%, I don't know how valuable he can be to the team. And then, yeah, he just has to beat out Barton, Craig, Michael Porter Jr., Jeremy Grant, Vladko Chanchar. All of those guys are, and even Malik Beasley, all of those guys could play whatever minutes he is going to play, and that's just tough for him. My prediction, I think he looks great in the chances that he gets. I think he shoots 39% from three, which would be great, especially since that's what he's in there to do. But I don't think he plays consistently enough for most of the year. He's coming to be coming off of the Euro or FIBA World Cup, and there is a chance that he enters training camp in the best shape of, you know, a lot of players, they come in good shape, but they're not in like mid-season form. There's a chance Juancho comes in at mid-season form and just looks phenomenal through training camp. There's also a chance he doesn't participate fully. I think this happened a few years back. I think the year he got mono, he comes in off of playing Euro League or, you know, one of those tournaments, and he actually sat out most of training camp, and then next thing you know, he has mono. So there's a chance that either of those things happen, and I just think it's going to be hard for him to win over Malone to get enough minutes, given that Michael Porter Jr. is going to take priority, even if he's not as good as Juancho. They just know he's, you know, his ceiling is higher, so they want to give him those moments. And then I put traded at the deadline for Juancho. If Denver's not going to play him this season, I don't know what the point is of going into the summer with him, so he's another trade candidate. When we come back, Paul Millsap is on deck. And it's going to be interesting kind of talking about him, because he's a guy that I think can really go either way. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you, the NFL season starting. Check out Locked On NFL. Cody Rourke with Locked On Broncos has you covered. And then if you cover another team for whatever reason, you traitor, check out that team. We have Locked On Dolphins, Locked On Patriots if you're a horrible person, Locked On Raiders if you're even worse of a horrible person. So check out whatever it is you want for Locked On NFL. Those are up and firing, and there's a lot of good stuff there. Paul Millsap. Over the last three seasons, including this last one in Atlanta, and then there's two here in Denver, he's gone from 34 minutes per game 3 years ago to 27 minutes per game last year. And it's been a pretty linear reduction, I think, from 34 to 30, from 30 to 27. So he is clearly on the decline. I mean, he's 34, 30, what is he, 30, 33, 30, I think this might be his age 34 season coming up. This will be his age 34 season coming up. So it's expected. I mean, he's at the age where he should be reducing his role. But the question now is 27 minutes per game last year. How much lower does that go? 25, 24? I talked on the last episode about Andre Iguodala in Golden State, who had a much thinner roster than Denver. Denver, very deep roster. If they had a much thinner roster, he only played 23 minutes per game. So is it possible Millsap's regular season role is reduced that much? That's a big question coming into the season. Last year, 12.6 points per game. So in addition to his minutes going down, his production on the offensive end also going down. And he has slowly segued into a very low usage role. And he might be in line for an even further reduction. You know, last year I thought Denver used him as an isolation score. They have a couple sets, some of which here in the upcoming season I'm going to be breaking down, doing some really cool. I got a really cool weekly series I'm going to be doing that I'm very excited about, kind of breaking down certain plays and what the team uses them for. A couple isolation sets to get Millsap the ball on that right elbow where he can attack in space. I don't know that Denver's going to go to that well too much anymore. I don't know if they should. He was very good in that role this last year. But I don't know that Denver needs to sort of be investing in a Paul Millsap ISO. It did come up in the playoffs. There were moments where Millsap, you went to Millsap in those moments and he gave you a big bucket. It allowed Jokic to rest. It just gave a different look. It keeps teams on their toes. You know, they think so much, and especially in a playoff series, you think, okay, who is, you know, Millsap's a low usage guy, so we're going to stick so and so on him because we got to really load up on what Jokic is doing over here with all that. Well, you overcompensate that, and then when Denver goes to Millsap, he can just dominate whatever weak defender you put on him. So having that in your back pocket allows Millsap to keep the defense honest and maybe prevent other teams from putting lineups on the court that maybe can take advantage of the fact that Denver never uses them. So maybe he's not in line for a reduction of those ISOs. Maybe it's still something Denver will rely on, but my hunch is that they'll use it a little bit less than they did last year. The Nuggets last season were 49-21 in games Millsap played. That's a 57.5 win pace. And 22-16 the season before. There is a non-basketball person in town that loves to talk about how much of an expert he is, who hates Paul Millsap and thinks he's like the worst player ever and an anchor to this team. Denver's record, 49-21 last year with Millsap, says otherwise. Millsap is a subtle player, and a lot of what he provides to Denver is not flashy and maybe doesn't jump off the page. And yes, in Game 7, he was terrible. In the final game of the season where Denver went down, he was not very good and he did not come up big. But that does not erase the fact that for two seasons now, Millsap has clearly, very easily been the team's second best player. And I would say second most important player. Jamal Murray has had the higher highs, and I think he's more important to the team's like big success because he elevates the team to new heights when he is really on, and Gary Harris has had his moments. But Paul Millsap, and the numbers don't, if you just talk about raw on-off plus-minus or win record when he's in the lineup, Nuggets are just so much better with him. It is, I think, inarguable that he's was the team's second best player. And there's a chance that he still is. I mean, he means that much to the defense on the defensive end of the court. I think other guys, Gary Harris and Jamal Murray, are in line to sort of pass him by this season. But I think coming into the season, Millsap easily the second best player. He's still the defensive anchor. He also saw a huge bump in his offensive rebounds per 36 minutes this last year. So his minutes went down, but his offensive rebounding went up. So in Atlanta, his final season, 1.7 offensive rebounds per 36 minutes. Two seasons ago, in his first season in Denver, 2 offensive rebounds per 36 minutes. Last year, 2.9. So he saw a huge increase. And perhaps this is a result of Millsap sort of learning how to play alongside Jokic and what's needed. I mean, Millsap's a very smart player, and he's a great sort of like guy at fitting into whatever is needed. There's a chance that Millsap at this very moment understands better than ever what his role is alongside Jokic and what he is supposed to do. And you factor in, even in getting older, when you just know your role better and understand the angles and the timing and the tendencies of players, you know, that familiarity is important. Continuity is important. Somehow, some people, I think, are discounting how important that those types of things are, but continuity is important. There's a chance that Millsap better understands his role here. He had the best field goal percentage of his career last season when you factor in volume. He did shoot better one season, you know, but he only took 23 attempts, so we got to throw that one out. Last year, you know, took quite a few and shot a respectable, I think, 36.5%, which for him is really, really good. Well above his career average of 33.5%. So there's also a chance that as he gets older, he's becoming a little bit better of a three-point shooter and more confident in it. I will say I don't think he's ever going to stretch the court, though. He has a very slow release, and 36.5%, as good as it is, teams know that he's not going to make more than two or three of those in a game. And if you left him open all game, you know, it'd be really tough to imagine him having five, six, seven three-pointers. So, it's good that he's knocking those down. It opens things up, but I don't think he's going to be a guy that changes and bends the defense because of his three-point shooting. And then Jokic-Millsap combo was the second most used duo of all Nuggets combos and the highest raw plus-minus. So when that duo was together, and this has been true for 2 years now, when those two are on the court, it doesn't always look pretty, but they are dominant, and they are the second most important duo of the last 2 years for Denver behind the Jokic-Murray duo. So really, one big question you have is that those two guys already, we talk about, Grant playing Jeremy Grant a little bit more or whatever. Jokic Millsap has been such a big part of why this Nuggets team won 54 games last year. And any reduction in that, just like we talked about with Plumlee, anytime you take away from something that works, the new thing has to work even better than that. And that's what, you know, when we talk about Jeremy Grant, for him to really steal minutes from Millsap, not only would it be an age, like, just he's getting older, so he's going to play fewer minutes, but Jeremy Grant would have to produce at such a high level to match what Millsap has done. Best case scenario, I kind of alluded to this, but there's a chance that he just has the best chemistry with Jokic yet, and we kind of are getting the best Jokic-Millsap duo that we've seen. I think 27 minutes per game, equal to what he played last year, is the best case scenario. I don't see his minutes going up, even in a best-case scenario. I do not see him playing 30 minutes per game, especially when you factor in that the team has Plumlee and Grant and all these other options. 27 minutes per game is the absolute peak I could see Paul Millsap playing. I think 38% from three. He's never done this, so it's kind of weird that I put this on there, that a player in his age 34 season would have the best three-point season of his career. But, you know, just looking at the trends, you could see it. It would make a little bit of sense that he's been working on it. He's segueing into more of a perimeter-oriented role, so maybe this is the year he shoots 38%. I put 11 points per game, so even down from what it was last year. I think even a best-case scenario, he's scoring a little bit less than he has in the past. But I think remains defensively stout. That's the biggest thing. I think there's a very real and realistic scenario where he's still the best defensive player and has the biggest impact on the defensive end of any player on the Nuggets roster. And then comes up big in the playoffs. So we talk about the Iguodala, and I've been comparing him to Iguodala for a couple weeks now. There is a chance he plays 27 minutes per game in the regular season, and in the postseason he plays 33, 34 because he's that important to the team, or maybe even more than 33, 34. What did he play this year? I have it right here in front of me. He played 33.5 in the playoffs. So maybe he gets back to that in the playoffs, and you're saving him basically all season to kind of extend his career and keep him fresh. I think that's very likely. Worst case scenario, he just looks old. A lot of times, players, especially bigs, when their time is up, it comes quick. It happens fast and in the blink of an eye. I don't think that's happening with Millsap this year, but there is a chance, and that's the worst case scenario, is that, you know, maybe they try to ISO him in the first couple months of the season. It just never works, and his ISO numbers are so down, and his shots at the rim and field goal percentage at the rim are so down, and then defensively he just doesn't quite have the same impact that Denver's expecting. I think there's a real chance that happens with him, even if it's a low chance. And then 32% from three or worse. He did this 2 years in a row, his final two seasons in Atlanta, where he shot 31%. There is a chance that he's just not that great of a three-point shooter. And even though he's had 2 years in a row where he's gotten better, and even though that's a big emphasis in his game, and, you know, clearly that's what he's been working on in summers, and you expect him to come in better, there's a chance he just doesn't have his legs under him and he shoots 32%. And then I think worst case scenario, 23 minutes per game. I don't think Denver would cut him out of the rotation entirely. Maybe he's a trade chip because he's an expiring. So if things really went south, you could say, okay, here's a $30 million expiring contract you can do some fun stuff with. But I just don't see him playing fewer than 23 minutes per game, no matter what happens, even with all the talent that they have behind him and Jeremy Grant and Mason Plumlee. My prediction, 26 minutes per game. So he played 27 last year. I think 26, you know, it's a 1 minute reduction, but he's still so important to the team's success. And he's so good that I think he's going to play a lot. And 26 minutes per game, if you get below that, you're talking about some real choppy minutes. And I just don't see that. I could see him playing, you know, 60 games, 65 games and sitting out a lot of games, just not playing, getting a lot of maintenance or whatever. But I don't see him playing fewer than 26 minutes per game. 34% from three. I think, you know, last year's 36.5, maybe a little bit high. If you look at some of the career averages, I think 34 is probably more likely for what he is. I think he looks slightly less effective, but also reduces his usage to the lowest level yet. I think he's even more of a screener and role player, and that might be a good thing. The more you play through Yoke, the better. And yes, he needs a break every now and then, but I think guys like Will Barton, Jamal Murray, Gary Harris are more in line to be the guy to give Jokic that break and not necessarily Paul Millsap. So there's that possibility. I think fewer ISOs. I think he's still a reliable defender. I think he's still probably the most impactful defender, and the numbers will bear that out again. I think he remains a key piece of the team's success. The key question, and this is maybe the biggest question surrounding him and how the team has to approach it. They would never admit this, by the way. You could ask them this at media day or whatever, but they would never admit this. But how much does Mike Malone and or just the Nuggets organization feel the need to wean themselves off of Paul Millsap? He is in the final year of his deal, as is Mason Plumlee. Jeremy Grant, by all accounts, the Nuggets want him to be the power forward of the future, at least of the immediate future. So how much do they look at it and say, you know, Millsap's still the best option, but we need to get a good sample size with Jeremy Grant, and we need to sort of get him familiar. I just talked about how Millsap, after two seasons, has better chemistry with Jokic than ever before. You don't want to waste too much time with Jeremy Grant on the bench if you want to kind of speed up that process. So that's one of the big questions I have. Does his minute load go down to like 25, 24, not because he's not good enough to play more or healthy enough, but just because the Nuggets are looking forward and thinking we need to use October, November, December to prepare for not just the rest of this season, but years to come? That's a real question. It's going to be a tough one, but we'll see. But Millsap's still a really, really important piece of the team. And the Nuggets, I say this all the time, the Nuggets would not be, if they were to lose Paul Millsap this offseason, even with the acquisition of Jeremy Grant, they would not have nearly the upside, in my opinion, that the team has now. He is still such a crucial part of the team, and if you lose him, as great as Jokic is and Murray and all those other guys, they would have lost the thing that makes them, over the last 2 years, has made them an elite team, not just a very, very good or fun offensive team. So Millsap, an important piece. Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody. We'll be back on Wednesday with a brand new episode, I believe, wrapping up this series. We got Jamal Murray coming up. Should be a really, really good one. Michael Porter Jr. as well. So I think we're going to end with a bang. We'll see everybody then.
Thank you for listening to the Locked On Nuggets podcast. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and visit us on the web at denverstiffs.com.